Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Bjorn Ihler, who is a peace activist, writer and filmmaker working against dogmatism, particularly in the forms of racism, hatred and violent extremism. His work is greatly founded on his experiences as a survivor of the attack on Utøya Island in Norway in 2011. He's written numerous articles for national and international newspapers. He's been an inspiration to many activists through participation in conferences and organizations such as the Oslo Freedom Forum Against Violent Extremism and the Forgiveness Project. Bjorn has a degree in theatre and performance design and technology from the Liverpool Institute for Performing Arts, and in 2013 he collaborated in the writing of the play The Events by David Grieg, an account of a survivor resembling the events of the Utøya attack, and he's currently producing the film Rough Cut, Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity. Well, hello Bjorn, welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hello.
Well, could you begin, Bjorn, by telling us a bit more about your background?
Well, I started off studying theater in 2010 in order to better understand how we can use storytelling and creative narratives in order to shape people's views on political issues, especially things such as immigration and integration. As I grew up in a very diverse neighborhood in Oslo and kind of wanted to find other avenues in traditional political debate to approach such subjects. And that's really something I've found very useful after what happened in 2011. Much of my work right now is kind of using storytelling as a tool in peace building, really. I'm currently enrolled as a student taking a master's in peace and conflict studies, and it's proving extremely useful to have a background in creative narrative in shaping narratives for peace as such.
Yeah. You said before the interview that you really resonated with the ideas of one of our members, Ed Catmull, the president of Pixar. What is it about his approach to work and creativity that you find very helpful?
I think Ed Catmull has always been like a great example of mixing forms of art, if you like. He started off as a scientist, and now he runs a couple of the largest film producing companies in the world, creating beautiful animation. And just in the kind of meeting point between technology and creative narrative, there's a lot to be found. But also in kind of the meeting point of technology, creative narrative, and real life situations. So a lot of the films developed by Pixar and Disney Animation is extremely relevant to how the world functions, and it's a beautiful tool that can be used in many ways to enhance our societies. So I think that's an important aspect. But I also really enjoyed his book, Creativity Incorporated, where he describes the creative processes within Pixar, and especially the idea of the brain trust, which is a group of people working together to come up with even greater ideas than what an individual could ever accomplish. And I think that's something that can be applied in many other situations.
Including in the activism that you're involved in?
Yeah, definitely including in activism. We have so much to learn. We have so many ways in which we need to develop further and become even more efficient than what we are today.
Okay. Well, could you tell us something of the events of the 22nd of July on Utøya, what you experienced?
Well, I woke up on the morning of the 22nd being really tired as I arrived at Utøya Island the night before, and it was a summer camp, and loads of young people had gathered, and people were playing football and flirting, and I was staying up all night the night before chatting with people around the campfire, although there was no campfire as such, figure of speech there. But anyway, we were tired and kind of crawled out of our tents and into the various meetings that were going on the island, where we were learning about such things as educational policies, and I went to a meeting about Western Sahara and the current occupation there, and we listened to this lady speak about how it is to run youth politics in Western Sahara, a country that's currently occupied by Morocco, and where shootings and attacks sometimes occur. And I remember sitting there and kind of thinking, this is so far from my reality.
Yeah.
And then moments later, we were in a quite similar situations in some ways. And well, after the meeting on Western Sahara, everyone was gathered, and we were told that there had been explosion in Oslo, which is my hometown and the hometown of many other people who were there. So we shared mobile phones and looked pictures, and it really looked like, you know, our hometown had turned into downtown Baghdad or something like that. The explosion was so severe, and it was really evident that something had gone terribly wrong.
Yeah.
So we stayed around and discussed what had happened in Oslo. We tried to get hold of friends and family for a while, and after a while we started hearing these popping sounds, and I didn't recognize the sound of a gun at that point. But to me it sounded like fireworks or something like that. I thought someone was trying to scare us. In hindsight, kind of after what had happened in Oslo. After a few minutes, we saw, I was in the camp area, kind of in the main part of the island at that point, and after a while I saw a man dressed in dark clothes walk up over a hilltop in the center of the island, and some people ran towards him. And he lifted the gun and shot them straight down. After which I turned around and ran into the woods along with a group of friends. Mm-hmm. And kind of immediately after getting into the woods and out of sight from the main camp space, I lay down on the ground and called my father. And after kind of trying to explain to him what was going on and get a better understanding of the situation, I went down to a track that goes around the island. And I spoke to people, tried to get to be quiet, get them to be quiet and hide. Along that track was a little boy. He just sat there. So a friend of mine and I went over to him, and we decided to take care of him. So I took a little kid and we hid together in the woods, and we stayed on the ground in the woods for about half an hour or so while the shooting was going on constantly around us. And it was really difficult to identify where the shooting was taking place, because there's a lot of echo on the island, so okay. Locating it by sound is quite a challenge. But after about half an hour of trying to keep this kid calm and things like that, the shooting got really close, and a group of people came running through the woods, and in that group was another little kid who was the friend of the first little child, and the first little child and I joined up with that group and ran along with them through the woods away from where we'd recently heard gunshots. We ran along the track and tried to keep track of what was going on around us. And at some point we had to leave the track because there was a pile of people who had gotten shot right there. And my brain can't really cope with that still. It's not something that you're supposed to see, I think.
Yeah.
So it's extremely challenging in many ways, and I kind of blacked out after that, but I distinctly remember a mobile phone ringing in that pile, and just the devastation of the kind of fact that someone tried to reach someone in that pile and would never be able to reach them is still something that's kind of lingering with me now.
Mm-hmm.
but we had to move on. So even though I blacked out, I knew where the kids were, but that's everything I know. So I ran with the kids to the southern tip of the island, from where we could see helicopters and boats and such. And there was the longest line of blue flashing lights from emergency vehicles on land. And we really thought that a while had passed now and the police would be there. So we sat down and we contacted the mothers of the kids, and I called my father again, and then someone came out from the bushes behind us wearing a police uniform, saying that they'd caught the bad guy. Moments later, he lifted his gun, the man in the police uniform. It turns out that was Breivik. And he started shooting at our group of people. So I jumped in the water. The last thing I told my father was that a police officer was there and we were safe. So I jumped in the water and my phone stopped working. And I swam straight out and the kids followed me. Then I was wearing a woolen jumper, so I sank, and I managed to pull that off and stood up in the water and looked back towards land. And I remember seeing Breivik take aim at me and firing, and luckily he missed. But that's also a moment that sticks with me. I remember a very kind of firm feeling that this was the end.
Yeah.
I described it previously as a feeling of my soul leaving my body, and it's really weird to kind of recognize the fact that you are dead and then not be dead. Mm-hmm. So I survived that, and decided to swim around a corner of the island, and the kids followed me there, and we stayed kind of in the water around the corner from where Breivik was for a while, and Breivik went back up onto the island and got captured by the police just moments later. And we crawled back up onto the island and waited to get saved, pretty much. One thing that kind of always feels important to mention about this story is the fact that the situation itself was so surreal, and we had to act so much on instinct that it kind of it feels kind of less important than what happened afterwards in some ways. We were gathered at the center, a hotel later, where parents came to gather their kids, and some of the parents were of course not going to find their kids there.
Yeah.
And at that point, we kind of had more time to recognize what was going on around us. And I just remember realizing that fact and looking at some parents who had been sitting there for hours just waiting for news on their kids. And it's so heartbreaking to think back at that, and that situation and those parents.
Those two little boys that you mentioned, they lost their, it was the other way around, they lost their parents, didn't they?
They lost their fathers. And their fathers were security guards on the island. One of them was a police officer spending his vacation time protecting the island. The other one was a security guard, and they'd been there for every year, as long as anyone can remember, I think. And their sons had pretty much grown up on the island.
How well were you supported and the other survivors after the event, and what lessons could have been learned there?
I mean, there's a lot to be learned. We weren't very well prepared for this kind of terrorist attack in Norway. None in the psychological welfare system had any clue on how to deal with it, really. We were instantly being kind of labeled as victims and as people who would be hurt for the rest of our lives. And I think that's had like an amazing negative impact on a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because people got this narrative within themselves that they were victims and would forever be hurt by this. And it kind of became a reaffirming prophecy, if you like.
Sure.
So that was very bad, and I got the sensation from my kind of psychological health at first in Norway that they were there more to pity me than to help me move on, which felt kind of more destructive than productive. So I got kind of in a situation where I got help from a research institution doing research on post-traumatic stress disorder rather than by the welfare system as such. And they had some more clue on kind of how the mechanics of PTSD are and what process the body and the brain goes through, and getting an understanding of that was very important in my treatment. It actually got me back on track to an extent where I was able to, in September 2011, move back to England to study where I was studying to begin with. After a while in England, I was going back and forth between Norway and England for quite a bit, and then in 2012, in the fall of 2012, I started getting support from a gentleman in Liverpool who had been working with the army and the police for ages and really understood kind of the processes of post-traumatic stress, but also how to move on with your life. And he really helped me push through my bachelor's degree, and I think that was extremely important in kind of regaining my own life and control over my own life, if you like.
Yeah. Part of the post-traumatic stress therapy is about telling the story. What is the rationale behind that, and how has that helped you, do you think?
Well, the rationale from kind of the psychological side is that when you tell your story, you in some ways relive it, and if you relive it many enough times and at the same time recognize that it doesn't have an actual impact on you, you will realize that it's no longer a threat to you, it's no longer a danger to you, so you will stop having the physiological reactions. And that will go down, and in many ways, I think that's a very good way of kind of dealing with the physiological reactions to your psychological problems with the story. I do, however, think that there's a prolonged process of telling the story that's important. I've kind of explained it through something I called artistic treatment. By telling the story, you take control in some way of what happened to you, and you become in charge of your own story. You choose which medium to tell it, and you choose how to tell it, who to share it with. And in some ways, it's about sharing a burden with someone. We are more people carrying my story now than we were 10 minutes ago when this started. And in some way, that's very helpful, but also just being able to express it and also having the feedback of what do you get out of it is important. And as you mentioned in the introduction, I helped out writing a play, and I think one of the valuable things of that was telling my story and then seeing what someone else got out of it and put into the play, and how they chose to bring my story on in a different format, if you like. So just externalizing the story in some way is extremely valuable.
Do you think also the fact that you've had an artistic background has helped too?
Oh yes, definitely. It's been extremely valuable. Both because that gives me an opportunity to explore the story itself, but also because it gives me an opportunity to kind of look at the wider perspectives. And that's something I want to talk more with you about. It's kind
sure.
of taking that step backwards and looking at the broader picture, and where does my little story fit into a broader picture.
Yes. Okay, well, we'll come to that later on, Bjorn. But a turning point for you was seeing Breivik in the courtroom. Why was this important?
Well, after what happened, Breivik kind of got a very big role in media and such, and people were kind of starting to dehumanize him, talking about him as pure evil and things like that. But also because of my experiences with him on the island, he still existed in my head as a very powerful person, someone who was capable of murdering me if he wanted to. and seeing him in court was kind of the visual manifestation of the fact that he was no longer in charge. He didn't have any power anymore. He was handcuffed and he was guarded by police, and he was in such a reduced position. And that kind of, to me, revealed his humanity. And even though people have been speaking about him as a monster, I felt it was very important then and there to just take a moment to realize that this is another human being here. Every human being is responsible for their actions, but no human being is necessarily born evil. So what brought this human being to this place where he was capable of killing us? And that's really something I'm still working on, revealing, if you like.
Could you describe the impact that this whole event has had on Norwegian society?
Well, there's definitely a kind of... The event stays with Norwegian society in many ways. It's constantly part of the public debate and things like that. We've kind of always focused more in Norway on the threat of Islamic terrorism, and we're going back to that, and I think that feeds into a narrative that's not necessarily healthy when it comes to right-wing extremism. So in many ways things are exactly the same as how they were about 4 years ago. I think in the immediate aftermath of what happened, there was a greater sense of unity in Norway. And we had the sense of a more inclusive society, and I think in some ways that's been very good. But we kind of reverted back to how things were in that sense as well. So there hasn't been much change.
From a perspective from the UK, a lot of people thought it was a very mature response, especially when Breivik wanted to be declared sane, and I can remember there was a poll or a survey of the Norwegian population, and they agreed with him. I mean, it just made me think, if there'd been some like the equivalent of in the UK, we had a horrific murder event in the 60s. It was called the Moors Murderers. The guy called Ian Brady, if he had wanted to be declared sane, everyone would have said he was insane, or if he wanted to be declared insane, everyone would have gone the opposite way. But there was a sort of feeling that people looked at the evidence and said, well, yeah, okay, fair enough. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, first of all, the kind of evidence base of sanity was fairly strong. At the same time, I also think it was extremely important to recognize Breivik as sane, because sanity kind of gives him responsibility to another extent than if he was declared insane. He couldn't have been trialed as a criminal if he was insane. And I think for a lot of people to cope, it was important that this was something planned and performed by a sane man rather than an act of insanity from someone insane. And also, a lot of that tied into Breivik's ideology and the fact that we couldn't declare everyone supporting the same ideology insane, because that's such a large group. And a lot of ways that has been very helpful in trying to work against ideology, because we need to recognize that the ideology is actual. It is an ideology that belongs to a large amount of people. Those people are not insane. And that also kind of feeds into the fact that people try to dehumanize Breivik in some way, and the recognition of his humanity, as I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, and just staying on the subject of responsibility, would you say the sentence was appropriate?
Yes. One of the kind of discourses after what happened was whether we should change the legal system or not in Norway in order to be able to deal better with this kind of terrorism. And my very strong argument was that we shouldn't give the terrorist the power to change the core values on which Norway was built.
Yeah.
And we have a prison system now which allows for a maximum sentence of 21 years, and then you can get additionally imprisoned for 4 years after a hearing, and then 4 years after that again, and so on for the rest of your life. But fundamentally the prison system is based on people's ability to be reintegrated in society. And that means we have a very low rate of repetition. Repeated crimes are very few in Norway. So the system actually works in that sense. But this was also a chance to demonstrate that it works on crimes of a larger magnitude, if you like, and that it was able to deal with this in a similarly humane way to how Norwegians generally deal with these sorts of issues.
Norway and the Scandinavian countries in general have been at the forefront of restorative justice and getting perpetrators and survivors together, and it's often been very successful. Could you imagine, from your understanding of Breivik, that he could ever go through that process?
I'm not entirely sure. I've spoken to a lot of formers, and I work with a lot of former right-wing extremists on a daily basis, and they have reformed, and I believe that Breivik could potentially reform as well. But I'm not sure how he's going to be able to cope with what he's done and just the magnitude of his extreme actions. So it's really difficult to envision a reformed Breivik in many ways.
Yeah, you said that that forgiveness is perceived somewhat differently in Norway than in the rest of the world. Could you say what you mean by that and how that would relate to an extent to Breivik and the events?
Well, forgiveness, as it's understood in Norway and also other parts of the world, is kind of allowing for what happened, saying that it was okay in some ways. That's very often how we perceive the concept of forgiveness. How it's kind of used in other parts of the world, as I referred to in that quote, is more as a process of reconciliation, of understanding what happened, recognizing what happened, but then also being able to move on in a constructive way from that, often with a basis in what happened. And I think it's important to understand that differentiation when trying to move on in a way from terrible events like these.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me, Bjorn. Okay, well, let's move on now to focus a bit more on your work. Why do you think people become extremists?
Well, one of the fairly consistent stories is people who feel that they don't belong in their communities. They feel alone, and they really need a sense of belonging somewhere. So they join up with gangs, and often gangs that subscribe to a violent extremist ideology. So in some respects, that's kind of a gang issue as well. We see more and more kind of lone wolf extremism these days, and my theory on that is that gangs doesn't necessarily have to exist just in the real world, but also exist online. So we see a fairly high rate of criminals who have kind of originated in the community surrounding websites like Stormfront and things like that, which is a far-right extremist website that Breivik also belonged to. Mm-hmm. So they belong in other kinds of gangs or cultures, if you like. So there is the sense of belonging, but there's also a kind of recognition of grievances. And if you look across Europe at the moment, at least, after the financial crisis, a lot of people lost their jobs or have the perception that their jobs are in jeopardy, and economic issues kind of result from that. And there's very much a narrative kind of blaming that on immigration and multiculturalism from the far-right populist parties. And I think kind of recognizing the grievances, saying that there are economic issues, but offering other solutions is a good way of getting people to recognize that you can't necessarily just blame others and things like that. And the kind of far-right populist parties have a tendency to feed into the far-right extremist movements.
And you mentioned solutions. What potential solutions could be offered?
Well, to a very large extent, education is something I think is key, both on how cultures function. No culture is static, first of all. That's something that everyone needs to realize. That doesn't mean that your identity is under threat. It just means that society around you is never going to be static. But we also need to educate ourselves and trying to be critical to the narratives that are told us by authority figures. If a far-right populist party says that their jobs are stolen by immigrants, then we should question, can you show me the data on that? And you should look to a broader spectrum of narratives and say, well, what are those other political parties saying and things like that. So we need to be critical and draw from multiple sources, if you like. And a lot of this can be embedded into the educational system, I think.
And would you say critical thinking, the subject itself would presumably be very, very useful there?
Yeah.
What about in your own country? Is that something that's part of the education system?
Well, it is supposed to be embedded in the educational system. I think it would be better to have separate subjects on it, things like that. It's integrated in other subjects now, I think. But it's something we always could improve on. I myself went to an international baccalaureate high school, and we had something called Theory of Knowledge, which was a subject purely focused on critical thinking and learning about using a diversity of sources and questioning everything. Yeah. Questioning everything is really one of my life mottos after that.
What age did you start that, Bjorn?
I don't know. I think I've always kind of naturally been drawn towards it. And I've always been reading philosophy and things like that. And it's always kind of fed into a critical thinking kind of aspect of my life, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, but do you think education would benefit if critical thinking and philosophy was actually taught from a very young age, from 4 or 5? Because it certainly in the UK, it's often something that people only start studying when they're 16.
I think it would be very helpful to learn that at an earlier age, and I think it also would create healthier communities for kids to grow up in.
Yeah.
I think it would help on issues related to bullying and all of that in the schoolyards from a very young age, and that could potentially be quite positive.
Yeah. What about mindfulness? Do you think that would help too?
Mindfulness is, what is really the definition of that? I looked it up earlier. mindfulness is more about sort of taking responsibility of yourself, I think, in many ways, and taking responsibility of your own ways of thinking and dealing with things. And if we teach mindfulness as that, then that could be quite helpful as well. You are responsible for your own behavior and your own thought patterns in some ways. So
sure, yeah.
you always have the opportunity of changing that through various processes. So I think that could be useful as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I think they also mindfulness training and critical thinking in some ways can go hand in hand, because with mindfulness you're training yourself to respond more to experience rather than just react to it, and so you can actually take a step back and then you can arguably think more critically about what's going on around you.
One of the things I constantly bring up in kind of talking about mindfulness and also about critical thinking is the ability to take a step back and look at the full picture, and understanding your context and your place really in a more complex picture, and kind of understanding and recognizing that is something that falls both into critical thinking and mindfulness. I do, however, think kind of mindfulness has a tendency to also be a terminology used by people who are very kind of touchy-feely kind of people. And I think in many ways, when teaching this kind of stuff, it's useful to stay more grounded in reality, or, well, something that more people can recognize and approve of. We should kind of accept people's skepticism as well, and work with that, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, I agree with you there, Bjorn. And then this whole idea of the bigger picture, moving back to the arts again, do you think the arts can help you cultivate a tolerance of ambiguity and see things from a wider perspective, and also then, as you say, have a more skeptical look at things?
I really think so, because art teaches you to explore, and it teaches you to question, and it teaches you to develop based on your exploration and questioning, right? So the process of creating art is really helpful in itself, but then also when you have created something, you can share it with others, and you can hear inputs from other perspectives, and you develop as an individual and as an artist, and you move on to making new art pieces based on your input or the input you've received. And through kind of it's hopefully a process that will go on for eternity, right, where we constantly learn and evolve and develop. And that's really what art is all about. It's about the manifestation of that process of development, I think.
You also talk about narrative, Bjorn, and changing your own story.
Well, I think everyone carries with them a story, and we all tell stories in our cultures, and our cultures very often have stories that are lifting people within our group up and looking down at people from other groups. And this kind of cultural narrative is something we carry with us. And we need to kind of change that story and recognize that we are all part of the same culture. We are all fellow human beings. And that happens both at the cultural level and at the individual level. So we should all carry our stories with pride. We should all be proud of our identity, I think, but we should also recognize that everyone else has an equal right to their story and an equal right to be proud of their story. And through telling our stories, we can break down barriers, we can get a greater recognition of other people and how they got to their points in their lives. So story here is really important, and the narratives we tell and the ways in which we tell them and the recognition of the impacts they have is something we need to look further into in order to understand how we can build more peaceful societies, I think.
Okay, and then for other survivors of hate crimes, what support is there out there?
That varies wildly from country to country. I'm kind of sad to say there's too little support out there, but it also depends a lot on kind of what kind of support you need, I guess. It's a very tricky question in many ways, because there is very little actual kind of organized support out there, but I guess the most important support is in people, and people have been really great in kind of embracing me and my story and other survivors of what happened. And I think when it comes to hate crimes, it's very important to get recognition for having survived something like that from other individuals. It's important to have the recognition that it was a crime of hatred rather than something else. And I think that's something you need to get from society and from the community surrounding you. So the greatest support is really to be found out there and in your community, from your family, from your friends, but also from neighbors you never talk to who recognize that, you know, this was horrible and it happened.
Do you think we listen to survivors enough?
I don't really think so. Or I mean, it's again difficult to say. We need to listen to survivors more, I think. We need to listen to stories of how people move on after pretty bad stuff happens to them, in order to also recognize that we are in our daily lives and our challenges able to move on. I mean, I listened to a guy who lost an arm and a leg in North Korea while gathering coal to feed his family, and then he fled from North Korea through China 600, no, 6,000 miles or something like that on crutches. And just listening to stories like that, you know, puts things into a quite radical perspective.
Sure.
So it's not always about like recognizing that someone has it worse than you, because your own pain is also really real. But it's about recognizing that we're all on these amazing journeys and they're all different and they will have different challenges. But in the end, it is a unique journey and it's your journey, and you need to recognize that for yourself, and you need to recognize the journeys of everyone else. And I think in many ways that's kind of the way forward. So listening to survivors is extremely important, but also recognizing that perpetrators are on their journeys, and their journeys have led them onto potentially more harmful paths, and then how do we change that in order to lead them onto more constructive paths, but also avoid people moving on to destructive paths is something we need to work on. So listening to both survivors and perpetrators is extremely important, I think.
Okay, what is your understanding of the middle way, Bjorn, and how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, I think for me, the middle way is very much about being able to take a step back and assess your situation and your surroundings. So you need to understand your context and how things will affect you in order to move forwards, and also move forwards in a constructive way rather than in a way that might be harmful to your surroundings. But in order to do that, you also need to acknowledge kind of your grievances, and you need to take responsibility for the way in which you act on those grievances, and act on them in a productive way. So it's pretty much all about understanding context and surroundings and looking at the bigger picture, in order to find your path, I guess.
Great. Okay, my last question, Bjorn. If people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Well, they could tweet me or follow me on Twitter would probably be the best way to go about that. I also have a website. I'm sure you'll post links to that, but the website is bjornih.co.uk, and the Twitter is at bjornih as well. So they all tie together. There's also a public Facebook page that you can like that will be updated.
Okay, well, Bjorn, it's been great talking to you today, and thank you for sharing your story. And what you've done to me is an inspiration. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you for getting in touch and letting me share my story.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.